Okay, so this is quite a short sutta, but it's there's actually quite a lot of content in it, so I'm not sure how long it's going to take. It might be a little bit, it might not take as long as I think, but we'll just see what happens, I suppose. So this is number 241 of the Salayatana Sanghuta. Salayatana means the six sense bases. So these are, of course, the Buddhist six sense bases are the five senses we normally talk about, the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body. In addition to that, you have the mental base, which is the kind of the six, the Buddhist sense base, which senses mental things, such as deep states of meditation, etc. So it's part of this one. So for that reason, yes, the six sense bases are involved in this one. So this is the simile of the great log. And as usual, if you have any question or any comment you want to make, please just stop me at any time and ask your questions. And then no question is too stupid, no question is too intelligent. You can try anything, and if you think I get it wrong, you can always correct me if you like. So it goes as follows. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Kosambi, on the bank of the river Ganges. The Blessed One saw a great log being carried along by the current of the river Ganges. And he addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Do you see, bhikkhus, that great log being carried along by the current of the river Ganges?" "Yes, venerable sir." "If, bhikkhus, that log does not veer towards the near shore, does not veer towards the far shore, does not sink in midstream, does not get cast up on high ground, does not get caught by human beings, does not get caught by non-human beings, does not get caught in the whirlpool, and does not become inwardly rotten. If all of these things are not the case, then it will slant, slope, and incline towards the ocean. For what reason? Because the current of the river Ganges slants, slopes, and inclines towards the ocean." So too, bhikkhus, if you do not veer towards the near shore, if you do not veer towards the far shore, do not sink in midstream, not get cast up on high ground, do not get caught by human beings, do not get caught by non-human beings, do not get caught in a whirlpool, and do not become inwardly rotten. If all these things are the case, you will slant, slope, and incline towards Nibbana. For what reason? Because right view slants, slopes, and inclines towards Nibbana. So here the simile here is essentially comparing a human being to a log in the river Ganges. It's interesting here how this actually comes about. How can a human being be like a log in the river Ganges? It sounds like you have no will, you have no power to do anything, you are just like a log being carried along by the stream. And of course, this is the whole point, I think, or part of the point of the simile, is that as human beings, we are essentially conditioned by things around us. And even our will, even our desire to do a particular thing or move in a particular way, all that is also conditioned by whatever influences we have on us as human beings. So even our will is influenced. It might seem like free will, but in reality, if you start looking inside, you will see that there is precious little free will in there at all, if anything, and that we are following along because of our habits, conditions, and the society and people around us. And if we are lucky, we condition in a good way. If we are fortunate enough obviously I will say that Buddhism is a good conditioning, otherwise I wouldn't be here. And hopefully you look at it the same way. But essentially, we're just using our past life, the conditioning in the past life, previous in this life, and then we think because of that Buddhism is a good thing to do. And if we are fortunate and we are wise, then we have found something which conditions us in a good way to make sure that we have happy results because of that conditioning. So this is how what it is really is like to be a human being. That is why you can compare a human being to this log. We're just being led along this stream. And this is the stream of the Dhamma. The Dhamma carries you along in this way here. And all these other things then, these are like the things which stop you from being carried along in the stream. So if you get cast up on high ground, etc., we'll see in a second what these things mean. It obviously stops you from moving towards Nibbana. So these are the problems. These are the things that we have to watch out for as we practice this path of Buddhism. And by the Buddha in this way, by warning us about these things, he gives us a chance to avoid falling into the trap of these eight traps, essentially. Yes, sir. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, it's a very good point. I mean, most logs will probably be trees in the forest, and they won't have a chance to go anywhere at all, and they will be at a loss. They won't be going in the right direction. So the reality is that for most people, you're just wandering around and around and around. That's what samsara is all about. That's why you've been there for so long, because you're not going in the right direction. So you have to have the right impulse to actually go in the right direction. So it is very difficult, and this is why, to reach enlightenment, one of the earliest causes is that you have to have the word of another, somebody else who knows the path. Otherwise, you can't even get started, usually. I know Ajahn Brahm, he likes this idea that even the Buddha may actually have heard the Dhamma from somebody else, because in the past life he met another Buddha, So even in that case, it might be... it's not as straightforward as you might think it is. Yes. What do you mean, similar force conditioning? They're all forces. They're all conditions. The Dhamma is just another condition, and everything is conditions. Everything is just conditioning, essentially. That's true, Jacob? Well, not necessarily so. And this is the thing. It is, traditionally the way that a Buddha becomes enlightened, or a so-called Pacheka Buddha, a private Buddha, becomes enlightened, is not by hearing the word of another. They do it on their own account. That is a traditional view of how a Buddha... So this is really Ajahn Brahm's idea that, even the Buddha heard it from a previous Buddha. But if you read the more orthodox view on that, that's kind of his, just to make it more interesting, I think, his kind of ideas. But the orthodox view in the sutta, not the sutta, as maybe the commentaries or whatever, is that... You can break through. And the Buddha never talked about having heard the Dhamma from the previous Buddha. So the impression there that he broke through, impression you get anyway, that he broke through on his own account. You mean to become a Pacheka Buddha? I think, I don't know, the impression you get when you read the suttas is that they have the ability somehow, the wisdom somehow, to penetrate this thing on their own account, without actually the conditioning from outside. So somebody realizes that, for example, if you take the awakening experience of the Buddha himself, he saw his past lives, he understood the law of karma, And when he did that, that might have been powerful enough for him to say to him that, well, this is absolute suffering, you know. I can't just go on with this. Anything is, you know, I want to get out of this. And that might be enough to turn his mind towards the ending of samsara. That's what basically Nibbana is, just the ending of samsara. So when you realize that something is no longer, you know, it's completely unacceptable, you might be able to do that. So, you know, something which otherwise you couldn't do. I don't know. This is my, you know, yeah. So, yeah. So, okay. So, so what he is saying here towards the end here is that it is right view that slopes and inclines towards Nibbana. This is what makes you go in the right direction. Of course, right view in the suttas is always of two kinds. There is the right view of the Aryans, of the stream enter, and this is the right view which has seen the Dhamma. And of course, once you have seen the Dhamma, that's why you call the stream enter. Literally, you have entered the stream of the river that takes you to Nibbana. So it makes very good sense that the stream enter is basically like a log on that river, and he knows that eventually he will go all the way to Nibbana, even if he gets stranded on the bank maybe for a while, or he gets caught on high ground for a while, eventually he will go to Nibbana. And this is the... So this fits very well with the simile, that the stream enter is a person who is like a log in the river Ganges going towards Nibbana. But the question arises, well, what about ordinary right view? Is it possible that ordinary right view, that, you know, you haven't actually seen the Four Noble Truths yet, you haven't understood the Dhamma yet, but is it possible that just this ordinary right view also ultimately leads to Nibbana as long as you keep that right view? And I think it may do. It may be part of this discourse. It's very hard to say, but I think it's possible. And usually, if it isn't explicitly stated that it's not, I think we can assume that maybe it is. And how does ordinary right view incline you to Nibbana? Well, first of all, ordinary right view, the first aspect of ordinary right view, which many people don't talk about, you haven't seen it talked about very much, is that you have to have the faith and confidence that there are people out there, like the Buddha, who have seen something that you haven't seen, who have understood something more profound, who have seen, as it says in the suttas, this world and the other world, and who have understood something more profound than most people. That is obviously the first thing you have to have faith in or confidence in. If you don't think that there's anybody out there who has this kind of understanding, there's no way that you're even going to start with practicing the Dhamma. You're even going to take an interest in the word of the Buddha because you haven't got that basic foundation of a sense of humility, of understanding your own kind of limitations and accepting that there are other people out there who know more than you. Just like we accept that there are doctors who know more about medicine than us, that there are engineers who know more about engineering, that there are dentists who know more about dentistry, in the same way, it is sensible to think that there are people out there who know more about us, about the reality of the mind and the body and the world, and about the spiritual path. I think that is a reasonable assumption to think that. And of course, once you have that one, then you start reading the word of the Buddha, and then the Buddha says, there is rebirth, there is karma. So because you have faith that there is somebody who knows what they're talking about, you place some confidence in that, that there must be this thing. Not an absolute confidence, but an idea that this may very well be the case. And that leads to two things. And that the first thing it leads to, and this is the traditional view in most Buddhist traditional societies, it leads to the idea that we have to do good actions to get a good rebirth in the future. That's obviously part of it. That's an important part of this idea of karma and rebirth. But that is only the beginning of what this actually, or the purpose of understanding rebirth and karma. Because the higher purpose of understanding this is that this is something which is incredibly undesirable. This idea of going round and around from life to life, sometimes suffering terribly, sometimes maybe being quite happy. And this is really the kind of the view that we should develop and understand. If you understand and accept rebirth, this is where it leads to. And this is the correct understanding of rebirth. And you will see this in the suttas again and again. The Buddha talks about having cried more tears than there are water in the four oceans, having spilt more blood than there are waters in the four oceans, through having your head cut off when you were, you know, a pig or a sheep, and all these kind of things. And you start reading that, you realize this is it's quite a terrible thing, going around and around like that. Sometimes being stupid, sometimes being wise, sometimes meditating and getting somewhere in your practice, other times regressing, going backwards, because you haven't got that foundation which understands things properly here. So this, and of course, once you have that view that samsara is something you want to get out of, then of course you are heading towards nibbana, because nibbana is nothing else but the ending of samsara, the cessation of this round, which is so full of suffering and full and absolutely unsatisfactory. So for this reason, I think that it is right view understood in the correct way, the correct kind of right view, not just the idea of getting a good rebirth in the future, but much more profoundly than that. It does incline, it does slope, it does slant towards nibbana. So that is what happens. And of course, if you practice then if you're not a stream enterer, if you're a stream enterer, even if you get caught by any of these eight, you will still ultimately move towards nibbana, because the catching, you will only be caught temporarily, and then you will actually move on again afterwards. But as a non-Aryan, one has to be very careful, because you can actually get stuck on the other bank or this bank or sink for a long, long time, indefinitely, basically. And that's why we have to be much more careful with these things if you haven't seen the Dhamma yet. Okay, so then I'll move on. And this is, now we get on to what these eight things actually are. So when this was said, a certain bhikkhu asked the Blessed One, "What, Venerable Sir, is the near shore? What is the far shore? What is sinking in midstream? What is getting cast up on high ground? What is getting caught by human beings? What is getting caught by non-human beings? What is getting caught in the whirlpool? And what is inward rottenness?" The near shore, bhikkhu, this is the Buddha replying, the near shore, bhikkhu, this is a designation for the six internal sense bases. The far shore, this is a designation for the six external sense bases. Sinking in midstream, this is a designation for delight and lust. Getting cast up on high ground, this is a designation for the conceit, I am. So here we have four of these eight ways of stopping your progress down that river. And the first one here is the six internal sense bases. So these are then the five senses plus the mind. And the next one, the far shore, are the six external sense bases. So these are the objects of the senses, the sounds, the sights, the smells, the tastes, the things you touch, and also the mental objects that you can have. And these two are basically two sides of the same thing. If you see, you must also have objects that you see. If there are objects, you must also be able to see them. So these go together. These are basically the same thing. So what does it mean that we get caught on the near shore or the far shore in this sense? And I think what is meant here is that we are not able to let go of these six sense bases or the six objects. In other words, there's still some sort of attachment there, some holding on, some desire, some craving for these things. And as long as you have that desire and craving, that means that you will get caught one way or another by these things. And the problem here is that the craving for these six sense bases is something which is very, very deeply rooted. I mean, to give up the six sense bases altogether, you have to be fully enlightened, because this includes basically everything that there is. And you will see that there are suttas which calls these six sense bases the all. The all, in other words, that which encompasses absolutely everything. So there isn't anything apart from this. So to be able to give these up, not having any attachment to them, not having any desire or craving for these things, you actually have to give up everything. Yeah. And certainly, as long as you're not a stream enterer, there's always something in here, something inside your mind, maybe even with the body, that you're going to hold on to as, this is me, this I am. And for that reason, you won't be able to give it up fully, certainly not, at least until you become a stream enterer. So if we can't give it up fully, then what should we do? How should we actually practice this particular thing? Yeah? How do we give these things up? How do we even know that we are giving it up? What is the kind of indication that these things are becoming, we're becoming less attached and we have less craving for these things? It's not obvious. If you look inside of your mind and you ask yourself, how much attachment do I have to the six sense bases? Well, how do you know how much attachment you got? It's very, very hard to say. And of course, the way to reduce that attachment is basically just the practicing of the Noble Eightfold Path. And as you practice that path, as you become more peaceful, as your meditation deepens, it is that fact that your meditation deepens, that you're becoming more peaceful, that your mindfulness is improving, that you're becoming more, you have more metta for the people around you, more compassion, more understanding. That is what tells you that you're actually becoming more detached from these six sense bases. The more attachment you have, the less progress you're going to make on the path. The more progress you make, the less there is of this attachment. And of course, there comes a point when you start really going into the mind in your meditation practice. And as you go into the mind, of course, these six sense bases are becoming much less powerful. They have much less draw on you, much less attachment that they can actually be there when you are letting go of, you know, the sight, the hearing, etc., and deep meditation. But ultimately, the only way that you can abandon these completely is by, you know, going all the way to the deepest possible meditation stage, such as, which is explained in the suttas as neither perception, no, sorry, as this is complete cessation, sanya vidayata nirodha, complete perception of feeling and perception, or, of course, becoming an arahant. If you're fully enlightened, you also let go of these things. So don't try to let go of these things, try to say, oh, I'm not going to be attached to this, I'm just going to let it be. Don't think like that. The right way of thinking, the right way of letting go of attachments, rather than trying specifically to let go of things, is to just practice the path, and letting go happens all by itself. I know that it's one of those common questions people ask, well, how do you let go? I don't know how to let go. What do you do to let go? And the reality is, you can't just choose to let go. It's not something you can do through an act of will. You have to do it and allow it to happen by practicing the Eightfold Path, and it happens then all by itself. Okay, Dalia, yeah. Yeah, go for it. No, that's okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, I was actually going to say that basically. So yeah. So good. Yeah. So basically, that is right. If you letting go, you do that by seeing that something is suffering that you thought previously was happiness, and when you actually understand that something is suffering, yes, you do let go of things. But the problem is that to be able to see that something is suffering, you have to be ready for that. You know. And sometimes that readiness only comes after a deep state of meditation, that you're actually able to penetrate that and see that this is suffering. Yeah. So it goes together. But you're quite right. If you want to understand that something has to let go of, you have to contemplate the suffering in something. Yeah. And then letting go happens by itself when you do that contemplation of suffering. That is quite right. So anyway, so those are the six sense bases, and that is the way to gradually overcome them by understanding the suffering, and then by simply practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. So then we come to the next one here, which is sinking in midstream, and this is a designation for delight and lust. And so sinking midstream, delight and lust then. So how do we overcome this delight and lust? How do we avoid getting caught by sinking in midstream? And of course, this again comes back to what we just were talking about now. To avoid that, the Buddha said that there's three things that we need to contemplate in this world. We need to contemplate the gratification in things. In other words, the pleasure in things around us. We need to understand the danger in things, the adinava, and we understand the escape in things around us. And the reason why we feel any delight and lust for things is because we are contemplating too much the gratification in things, too much the pleasure in things. So when you go out on a beautiful day outside, you think, oh, it's wonderful, it's beautiful. And I think everybody does that pretty much. I do the same, and it's interesting, even some arahats were saying how wonderful nature is. But basically, whenever you contemplate the beautiful in something, the wonderful food or the wonderful companionship with somebody or relationship or whatever it is, because you're seeing the beauty in something, you're basically developing delight and lust. And so the way then to get out of that delight and lust is to understand the suffering in things instead, to understand the danger that something has. So if you understand the danger in a relationship, that is when you will start to move away maybe from that, and you maybe at a certain point you might even become a monk. Sometimes you do the reverse, you are a monk and you start developing the delight in relationships and then you end up disrobing. Yeah, that can happen as well. But the point is that to whatever it is that you are delighting in, you have to actually see the danger in things. And that is how that delight and lust fades for things around you. So the point here, and I one has to be careful here, because it's not no good just to walk around in the world and just seeing everything as terrible and bad and all these kind of things. I wouldn't recommend that. But all you really need to do here is just to practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Practice the morality, practice the meditation, do those things that you're doing, and then you will actually see that by doing that much, delight and lust will fade all by itself. It's not good to go to such an extent that you start feeling depressed about things. That's not really the purpose of this. Sometimes if you take these teachings the wrong way, use them wrongly, you find that they actually become counterproductive, and you sort of allow yourself to be dragged down by them rather than be uplifted, which of course is the whole purpose of these things. So don't try to see everything as bad, but just practice the Eightfold Path, practice metta, practice compassion, practice kindness, all these things, and you will find that the delight and lust actually does gradually disappear all by itself. Yes? Yeah. 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 Okay. Yeah. True. Well, it's like the old simile of the ladder. You know, you have to let go of the lower happinesses first, and then the higher happinesses afterwards. So the purpose here is that the happiness that comes from metta and compassion is a higher kind of happiness, and that is why it is like an intermediate stage before you move even higher up. So you start off by, the purpose of metta is to get rid of, ill will and anger and all these kind of things. And there's a certain pleasure there with anger as well, otherwise you wouldn't become angry. And that's even in the suttas, the gratification in anger and ill will. So you start off moving away from the lower happiness to something higher. And metta also, if you practice it correctly, also takes you away from sensuality to some extent, because it gives you a sense of fulfillment inside. And metta also, if you practice to a very high level, it helps with samadhi practice. It's easier to get into samadhi. So essentially, you are leaving the sensual world behind to a large extent if you are successful with a metta practice. No, that's not... Yeah. No, it's not sensual in the sense of the five senses. I'm talking about five senses, sensuality, not the sixth sense, right? So this is in terms of the five senses, the happiness of the mind is not the sensual happiness. But it can be, depending on how you use it. But the pure happiness of the mind, which comes through metta or through samadhi, is a non-sensual happiness. Yeah. 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 No, that's what I mean. So you have to be careful. You know, this is what I was trying to say before. And one of the things which I find is so interesting in the suttas is that you have these arahants, these full enlightened people, living in nature and actually delighting in nature. You know, so it's not. I think that the delight in nature is maybe there can be a sensual aspect there, but I think it is very, very small, and I don't think it's something that you have to be too concerned about. I think there are other things which are much more difficult and much more. Yeah. Well, it's not well. Yeah. Well, it depends how you do it, how you enjoy it, you know. Sure. Yeah. That's worse. Yeah. Sure. Sure. I basically agree, and I think that what we, you know, the main thing in Buddhism, the first thing, what really matters is to overcome ill will, you know, and negativity. And this is difficult enough for most people. So I say focus on that one, and then you have a very, very beautiful life when you can do that, because you know, not having any kind of negativity and ill will is just it's a wonderful thing, because there's so much suffering in that sort of stuff. So that is what one should focus on. And I have there's no doubt about that. But obviously, my point is just that if you take metta and samadhi to a very high state, you will also naturally, after a while, start to leave these things behind you. I'm not saying that you should necessarily, you don't need to push it very much. You don't have to go there and think about, oh, this meal is actually suffering when it tastes really nice. That's not really what I mean. I'm just saying that, you practice your meditation practice, and after a while you will see that you become more equanimous, more even-minded about things like food, you know. I mean, there is a vast range from absolute greed, where you stuff yourself all the time because you can't stop eating, basically, to just enjoying the meal in a very peaceful way, with a peaceful mind. You can see inside your mind how much craving is there while you eat, and then you can tell roughly whereabouts on the scale you is. But the point, again, is simply that, you know, you do the practice, and as you become, your meditation deepens, and your morality deepens, and all these things, you will see that in the face of sensuality, in the face of food or whatever it is, you don't have the same craving as you had before. You become more even-minded. You may still enjoy the food, but it's an enjoyment in a different way, and it's a more kind of even-minded enjoyment, which is more peaceful, which is more beautiful, basically. One of the nice things the Buddha also said, he said that, after you come out of a jhana experience, that is when the food actually tastes the best. You have no sensuality. There's no sensuality there in the ordinary sense. But he said that whatever food you get then, even if it's very coarse food, it tastes like the food of kings, because your mind is so pure. But there's no craving there. The mind is completely at peace while you have that enjoyment. And that is that craving is the problem. And that is what takes the pleasure out of eating in the first place. So if you want real pleasure from eating, you shouldn't have an essential desire, basically. The less essential desire, in a very strange way, the more pleasurable the eating actually becomes. They're just pushing it too much. They're not allowing things to come naturally. You have to allow these things to come naturally. Yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay, Bronwyn. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's basically what I'm trying to say. Yep, that's quite right. Yep. So, yeah. Okay. Any more questions on that one? But it is a very good point that you're making, Rodney, and I agree with you. You know, you have to be careful not to sort of oppress yourself with the Dhamma. Sometimes you can use the Dhamma in a self-oppressing way. So that is that's a very good point. And I... You know, so you have to sort of hear the Dhamma from many different angles until you understand how you actually do this correctly. Yeah. This is a theme which goes through the suttas and through the Buddha's teaching all the way. The happiness of each stage of the path, and as you move up, it becomes more and more, more and more peaceful, more and more happy, basically. Yeah, and the happiness of renunciation is one type of happiness, and that means basically it means the renunciation of. Sensual pleasures, that's what it basically means. So it is a higher type of happiness. This is Scott. From the sensual pleasure, So it's like you... Yeah, I should maybe finish that off to make it more clear, is that you have the gratification in something, and then you see the danger. And as the Buddha says, whatever you look at in the world, you find that the danger is always much greater than the gratification. So because of that, when you understand both of those things fully, that's when you seek the escape, which is beyond whatever particular thing that you're focusing on. Okay, the next thing then is, the last thing here is, getting cast up on high ground is the designation for the conceit I am. So this gets to the very kind of the heart of what the Dhamma practice is all about, and this is also the most profound thing. This is the sort of thing which makes the Buddha's teachings exceptional, this idea that the conceit just basically means the idea I am inside of you. This, according to Buddhism, is called a conceit because actually it's not based on a reality. It's not based on something which actually is there. Every time you think the thought I am, it is a distortion of reality. It's a distortion of what things actually are. It doesn't correspond to anything inside of you. There's nothing there which deserves to be seen in this way as I am. So this is very profound. And when you abandon this so-called conceit, I am, then you... At that point, basically, you become fully enlightened because this is a very profound thing. And I often think one of the things which is interesting here is that sometimes you might hear, for example, in psychology or philosophy, you hear psychologists or philosophers that say that, we can see that there is no self in a human being. There's nothing permanent in the mind. We have investigated this. There's nothing there. I know one of the great philosophers of the 18th century, David Hume. He said that of himself. He looked inside of himself and said, there's nothing here. I can see that there is no self inside. And he rejected the idea of a self. So the question then comes up, does that mean that these people actually have penetrated the Buddhist truth of no self? That I am is a conceit, that I am is a distortion of reality? Is that what it means? Or Is there something more profound even than that with the Buddha's teachings? And the thing is that the answer to that question to me seems quite clear, is that there is something even more profound than that with the Buddha's teachings. So when you hear a psychologist saying, you know, we cannot find a self inside a human being, it doesn't actually mean that they have seen non-self. All it means is that when they look inside of themselves, that they're not able to see that despite the fact that they can't see anything permanent, they're still taking something to be permanent. And that is the weird thing here. And this is why this is so hard to see here. Because you look inside of yourself and you think, oh, I don't take anything to be permanent. But in fact, you still do. And that is why this truth is so difficult to see from a Buddhist point of view. Because you're not even able to see that you have a delusion, that you have a wrong understanding in the first place. If we could at least see that much, then it would be easy to move in the opposite direction. But we can't even see this. And that's why the understanding of non-self, the entering of the stream, of becoming a stream mentor, is so profound and is such an earth-shattering experience because it turns your world pretty much upside down and you see things in a completely new way when you do that. That is the conceit I am. And this conceit I am is in the sutta, a few suttas after this one, conceiving, it's called the proliferation, it's called the palpitation, it's called all these kind of things. And all of these things are essentially words for suffering in the Buddhist vocabulary. And they're all also not only suffering, but they also relate to the fact that these things are delusions and illusions. And they don't actually refer to anything which actually exists. So I am is actually a false notion, according to Buddhism. And, of course, I am is the most kind of basic way of looking at this. You can also, the alternative ways, more developed ways of that particular conceit is thinking I am this or I am that. So you're actually taking delight in a particular thing, maybe a mental event or your consciousness or something like that, or maybe your body even. Or even more developed ideas of self is, you know, not only I am this, but I will be such and such a thing in the future. It's like what they call an eternalist view. You know, you have this idea that you will exist forever or something in the future. Or the annihilist view, that I will come to an end when I pass away. This is also a delusion in Buddhism. Of course, it's a very common understanding in the modern world that when we die, we're going to come to an end. But according to Buddhism, this is just an illusion based on the idea that you are in the first place. So you think that you will be annihilated when you pass away. And it's wrong, as says the Buddha anyway. So these are some of those things. And you will see this is one of the things which distinguishes Buddhism from, for example, the Hindu religion. In the Hindu religion, you will say they take ideas such as I am that, I am this very seriously, or I am very seriously, and they identify with something, particularly some sort of mental phenomena, some mental bliss or something. In Buddhism, I am that, I am this, I am, is a delusion, it's a wrong understanding. So that is the conceit I am. It's a conceit in the sense that it doesn't actually refer to a reality behind it. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. And what bhikkhus is getting caught by human beings? Here, someone lives in association with lay people. He rejoices with them, sorrows with them. He is happy when they are happy and sad when they are sad. And he involves himself in their affairs and duties. This is called getting caught by human beings. So this is obviously addressed here to monks, but I think that some sort of ramification for everybody, whether you are a monk or a layperson or whatever. But of course, to the monks, what he is saying is that you shouldn't get too involved with lay people. You shouldn't get too kind of attached and too much involvement with them, because it will essentially hold back your practice of meditation. Any kind of attachment will tend to hold back your practice of meditation. It doesn't mean that you haven't got compassion or kindness. It doesn't mean that you aren't helping out when it's required, but it means that you mentally hold back a little bit. You don't involve yourself fully. You keep that sense of mindfulness and equanimity inside. Don't allow yourself to be emotionally dragged around by other people's problems. You keep a sense of cool inside of you. And there is another sutta, I think it's in the Dhammapada, which talks about this in a beautiful way. And it says that a monk or a nun should be like the moon. The moon is something which actually is very far away. But even though it's far away, it sheds light right here and now. We can know the presence of the moon. But even though we know its presence, it's far away physically. In the same way, a monk or a nun, according to this, should be, they can be present physically, but they should be far away in mind, in the sense of not being attached, not being too close, not being caught up, basically, in the kind of daily tribulations of maybe some of the lay people. And this is a nice way of basically saying that you should try to keep that even mind, that mind which doesn't get caught up. And of course, this is true not only for monks and nuns, but it's true basically for all of us, that we want to avoid getting too caught up in things, too caught up in other people's problems and even happiness. So we get dragged around emotionally. And this, of course, also concerns one's family. I notice that myself when I go back and visit my family, visit my parents. It's easy because they're so close to you and because you have some habits with your family that you get sort of pulled back into get drawn in emotionally into what's happening in your family. And it's much more difficult to keep your cool in that sort of environment than it otherwise is. And it doesn't mean that I don't want to see them. I think it's very important to visit your family and to support them and even to see if you can interest them in Buddhism. And I'm always very happy when my parents and my brother and my sister actually take an interest in Buddhism. I think it's wonderful. And it's actually happening recently that they do take an interest. I think it's absolutely great and marvelous. And the Buddha, of course, said that the only way that you can repay your parents is by making unvirtuous parents virtuous, or making unmindful parents mindful, ungenerous parents generous, etc. So I think it's great if I can teach them some Dhamma. I think it's absolutely wonderful. But at the same time, I also try to keep my cool and a little bit of kind of balance when I go back and see them. And in fact, I think that probably impresses them. If I keep my cool and I keep my balance, then I think probably they realize that something positive is happening with you. Okay. Okay, so that is the being caught by human beings, or avoid getting caught by human beings. And what, bhikkhu, is getting caught by non-human beings? And here someone lives the holy life with the aspiration to be reborn into a certain order of devas, thinking, by this virtue or vow or austerity or holy life, I will become a deva or one among the devas. This is called getting caught by non-human beings. And so this is basically, it's just a particular type of sensuality, because the deva world is usually a sensual world. So by having this aspiration, you're not really having an aspiration to go to a place beyond the sensual world. You're still thinking in terms of sensuality, still thinking in terms of enjoying yourself in the future, enjoying yourself in the sensual realm. And ideally, you should have the thought, the aspiration instead, to be reborn, or not ideally not to be reborn at all, and to go beyond the sensual realm, to go to like the Brahma realm, or to, in other words, attain these deep states of meditation instead. And this is actually, in one sutta, this particular thing is called a sexual fetter, is the most kind of refined of the sexual fetters, because it is still caught up in sensual pleasures, and of course that is included there. So the ideal aspiration is to go beyond this samsara altogether and not even get reborn in a very pleasurable realm, this deva realms. And the thing, of course, I know that many lay people, particularly traditional Buddhists, they think, oh, I want to get reborn in the Devaloka. But it's important to reflect on the limitations of that sort of thing. Okay, perhaps you are able, if you are very skillful and very reasonably wise, to get reborn in the Devaloka. Well, first of all, it's uncertain. You never know whether you will get reborn there. But even if you do, it only lasts for so long. And then when you come to the end of that life, which will eventually will happen, then what? You're back to square one again, and you're starting from scratch. So even though it sounds like you're living for millions of years in one of these devalokas, even though it sounds great, one day that end of life is going to be the present moment. And when that is the present moment, all that pleasure is behind you, and you're facing again an uncertain future. So this is, you know, that's what happens when you get to that point. So again, you have to go beyond even that. Then we have the second last one here, getting caught in the whirlpool. This bhikkhu is a designation for the five cords of sensual pleasure. So these are basically the attachment you have to sensual pleasures, to sights, hearings, smells, tastes, and also physical pleasures to the body. And basically the reason why you don't want to get caught in these things is because it's going to limit your potential for your meditation practice. Once you overcome these five cords completely, then, of course, that is when your meditation also can take off in a really deep sense. These five cords of sensual pleasures, they are what is also known as the first hindrance in meditation. You have the five hindrances. And when you abandon these, you are essentially also abandoning the other five hindrances. They are very closely related with the five cords of sensual pleasures. The other ones, of course, are the ill will, the sloth and torpor, the tiredness you have, the restlessness and remorse that you have from any bad things you've done, and lastly, any doubt that you have about the Dhamma teachings. So this is, ultimately, you have to overcome these things. And again, I again concur with Rodney, don't try to sort of be heroic and try to give all these things up straight away and sort of push them aside and create a lot of suffering for yourself. Practice the path in a gentle way, with kindness towards yourself, with loving kindness, with a sense of compassion towards yourself, and allow these things to fade away on their own account as you progress in that practice. Don't be some kind of super person who throws these things away once and for all, because you're likely that you're just causing suffering for yourself. And then the Buddha goes on. And what bhikkhu is inward rottenness? Here someone is immoral, one of evil character, of impure and suspect behavior, secretive in his acts, no ascetic though claiming to be one, not a celibate though claiming to be one, inwardly rotten, corrupt, depraved. This is called inward rottenness. And here, this obviously is a fairly kind of serious case of somebody. This obviously refers to a monk here or a nun, because people are talking about being celibate and not being celibate, although they claim to be one. So, of course, if you act in this way, you are creating very, very bad karma, according to Buddhism, because you're pretending to be a monk, you're pretending to be a nun. You are taking the generosity of the lay people who support around you by pretending to be in that position, whereas in reality you're not. So you are making lots and lots of bad karma by acting in this way. So this is being inwardly rotten. You're doing, this is a very serious bad thing, obviously. And the less inwardly rotten you are means that you keep, the more purely you keep your precepts, the more purely you keep your precepts, the more pure you are inside of yourself. This is called inward rottenness. And now we're coming to the conclusion of this sutta. Now, on that occasion, the cowherd Nanda was standing near the Blessed One. He then said to the Blessed One, Venerable Sir, I will not veer towards the near shore. I will not veer towards the far shore. I will not sink in midstream. I will not get cast up on high ground. I will not get caught by human beings. I will not get caught by non-human beings. I will not get caught in the whirlpool. I will not become inwardly rotten. May I receive the going forth under the Blessed One. May I receive the higher ordination. The higher ordination is like becoming a fully ordained monk or nun. And the Buddha replies, In that case, Nanda, return the cows to their owner. He is a cowherd, right? So he has to return the cows to the owner. The cows will go back on their own accord, Venerable Sir, out of attachment to the calves. Return the cows to their owners, Nanda. Then the cowherd Nanda returned the cows to their owners, came back to the Blessed One and said, The cows have been returned to their owners, Venerable Sir. May I receive the going forth under the Blessed One. May I receive the higher ordination. It's an interesting little paragraph here. I'm not exactly 100% sure why it is included, but I suspect the point is just to point out that the Buddha was very responsible, not only in terms of spiritual things, but also in terms of worldly things. He didn't want people to get a negative impression of him, that he was ordaining people without taking into account other people's property, etc. So he was responsible in a broad sense. As a monk, you have to not only make sure that you are good, but you also have to look good. If it looks like you're doing all kind of mischief, then of course that isn't going to have a negative impact, even though you might be pure under the surface. And it also reminds me of the Buddha when he left the household life to become a monk, to become an ascetic. In the traditional account, it always says that the Buddha sort of rode off in the middle of the night without saying goodbye to his family while his son and wife were sleeping, etc. That's what the traditional account says. But the reality, when you read the suttas very carefully, is it actually says that the Buddha, he left while his parents were crying and his parents were upset because he was leaving them. So in other words, he had obviously told them that he was going, otherwise they wouldn't have a chance to cry when he was leaving. And I say that what that means is that the Buddha must have made provisions for his wife, for his son, to be looked after before he left the household life. He didn't just go off in a kind of looking after his responsibilities before he left. And this is what I think is actually what really happened in that history. And sometimes the later thing, which are supposed to be like inspiring and wonderful and beautiful, actually sometimes it also has some negative effects in that it actually can look a little bit irresponsible, certainly by modern standards. So this is what I think is happening, that the Buddha is actually making sure that everybody is being responsible, that nobody gets hurt by this sort of going forth. Then the cowherd Nanda received the going forth under the Blessed One. He received the higher ordination, and soon, not long after his higher ordination, dwelling alone, withdrawn, diligent, ardent, and resolute, there's some things in between there. I think it says something like with his own insight or something like that, he penetrated the Dhamma, etc. And the Venerable Nanda became one of the Arahants. Arahants is the fully enlightened being. So this is what happens, according to this, if you dwell diligently, withdrawn, ardent, and resolute, practicing in the right way, you become fully enlightened. It's interesting here, it says soon, not long after his higher ordination, and this is a point that has been made here before, I think, but it's worth remembering that this doesn't mean like a week or two, this usually means years and years afterwards. It more means like maybe 10, 20 years according to the commentary, and that is soon in terms of the Dhamma. So, Danya. Yeah, I think so. I think the reality is very different from what it seems because, as you say, it's part of the Dhamma that you're supposed to discuss it. You're supposed to ask questions, you know, and you have many places in the suttas when monks go and ask questions of the Buddha, find out what the truth is. I think this sort of thing is just an exposition which shows you it shows you what actually happened. Eventually, he became an Arahant. What happened from the point he heard the sutta until he became an Arahant was probably lots of more discourses, lots of discussion, lots of meditation, all kind of things happening in between. So this is like giving you the main events, and that is the purpose of this kind of thing. Well, there is a sutta which talks about that, and it says that, you know, talks about somebody who knows lots and lots of suttas, but they haven't really penetrated and understood what the suttas are. And there's another person who's only read one verse, but he has understood that verse to the very end. And the Buddha says, well, he is the one who's doing it rightly, the one who's understood this one single verse to the end. And so this is the point, is that, you know, I personally like to read the suttas a lot. And as long as you feel that it's inspiring, as long as you feel that it's sort of pushing you in the right direction, as long as you find that you are learning something from this, I think it's wonderful, you know. Most people can't meditate all the time anyway. You need some other things to do. So I think it's great. So I personally, I certainly like to read the sutta, sometimes in great detail. So I think it's good. But I mean, you know, it's different for every single person. There isn't, like, you know, all of these things, there is no standard answer. It isn't like this is right, this is wrong. It's the effect it has on you which matters. Does it inspire you? Does it go take you in the right direction? Then it's good. I think it's both, probably. You know, it's dependent on the person. And this is like with your family, you're going to have to feel what is right. You know, what are they ready for? What are they interested in, you know? And this is one of the things also, you have to be careful not to push too much, because if you push too much and you say, oh, you should listen to this, you know, you get the opposite, always get the opposite reaction. So you have to know what is right. And you have to, the ideal thing is if they ask you and they say, you know, what does this mean? That is the ideal thing if that happens. And then, of course, you can answer the question. But I must admit, the reason I chose this sutta is because I read this sutta out in the monastery on Wednesday, so I sort of had it in mind already. But it is a very deep sutta, and I, you know, for people who are new to Buddhism, and I, you know, I feel a bit sorry that sometimes you read things which are too profound, basically, and people think, ooh, if this is Buddhism, then maybe it's not for me or something, because it is very profound. And I personally prefer to read things which are not quite as deep as this, I must admit. And then rather bring in a few deep things, particularly if people have questions, and then answer the questions at that point. Yeah, it's all time and place, you know. Yeah. Yeah, but you know, I mean, people who are interested in the Dhamma, they will read the suttas, and you will have questions, you know, to ask anyway. You know, there's always the best thing is to ask questions, because if you have a question, if somebody has a question, I know that they're interested. If I say something, 90% of the time, they don't catch it because they're not ready or something like that. I know that with Ajahn Brahm, he's been saying things every week. I hear a discourse from Ajahn Brahm in the monastery. And after 15 years, I hear something he has said every week for 15 years, and suddenly I hear what he's saying. What? Okay, now I understand. You know, and it's a bit like that. If you're not ready to hear something, you won't hear it. Even if you actually hear the sound and you understand the words, the meaning doesn't go in. That is the problem. Yeah. Yes? Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes, you know, people withdraw because they don't know how to do it right, basically, and they just get it wrong. And most of these things should happen reasonably naturally. You should feel what feels right, what feels good. You know, I mean, when I go back to my parents, I still give my mother a hug, for example, that's because Ajahn Brahm has given us that, and I reckon it's fine. You know, you can do that sort of thing. Yeah. But so you have to find that balance there somehow. It's true. Yeah. Okay. It's opposite. Yeah, exactly. It's actually interacting with more intelligence in a sense, more wisdom. You interact in a way where you don't get so pulled in and you don't get so dragged around and about by your emotions, but you actually interact in a wiser way. And this is one of the things that I tried to tell my parents, because they were very upset initially when I decided to become a monk and move to Australia, of all places, you know, halfway around the world somewhere. And of course they were upset. I can understand that. I understand. But I tried to tell them, well, you know, it's much more valuable to have a son who is a monk, somebody who you can talk to about, you know, really important things in life, somebody you can actually discourse with instead of just talking about, you know, worldly stuff, which doesn't really have any effect anyway. Why not, you know, it's great to have somebody you can talk to about these kind of things. You can talk about morality, you can talk about what is important in life, what really matters, rather than talking about politics or football or whatever else that most people usually talk about, you know. And I think after a while they actually have got that point, you know. Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, you know, most people talk about football all the time, you know. It's good to have a bit of Dhamma in there as well. Yeah. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. No, exactly. I agree. But I mean, you know, if I hadn't been a monk, you wouldn't have been able to talk about Dhamma at all. Dhamma would have been completely out, you know. So now it gives them a little bit of Dhamma, at least 5% of the time, 2% of the time. It's more than nothing here. Yeah. Yeah. It's the wrong way of doing it. Attachment is, people talk about attachment as if it's something you can remove through willpower. It's not. It's something we should remove through practice. It's a gradual thing, yeah, which sort of, you know, you feel it inside of you that it actually gradually is kind of decreasing. Yeah. It's like, you know, you feel more relaxed about things, more at ease. And yeah, it's a good point. And force is never really the right way. And this is what Ajahn Brahm teaches anyway. That's one of his teachings. Don't force things, you know, in the Dhamma practice, neither in meditation nor in kind of your, you know, outside of meditation, the way you think about the world or whatever, or people or anything. Yeah. Yeah. Indeed, this is one of the things which I find very fascinating about somebody like Ajahn Brahm, is that sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm is like a cult figure or a guru or something like that. But to me, Ajahn Brahm is the exact opposite of that, you know. He's the kind of person who is open to any challenge, any kind of argument. He doesn't have like an inner circle of disciples or an outer circle of people. Everybody is basically acceptable. I mean, I am one of the people who know Ajahn Brahm the very best. I don't have any special relation. I mean, obviously, it's a little bit special, but it's not like I have some special access to Ajahn Brahm, which nobody else has. I'm just one of the boys in the monastery, you know. And so for me, I find that very, it's a complete misunderstanding of the character of Ajahn Brahm to think that he has some kind of, he's like a cult leader or a guru personality and this and that. He's actually the exact opposite. It's very, very open and very, you know, you can challenge him. You can be offensive with Ajahn Brahm. He won't take any offense at all. And sometimes I find myself going a bit too far, and I think, "Ooh, I better be careful what I say because I'm making some bad karma here." By the way, I, you know, interacting with Ajahn Brahm, so that's the danger actually with somebody like him. So, anyway, yes, Lina. It's very. I don't really know what he is talking. You know, what this is all who he's talking to here. I think that he was talking to monks here, but obviously there were some lay people in the audience as well because they wanted to go forth afterward. But I think it's probably a mixture, you know. And I think that this sutta can be read on both levels, both as being about stream enterers, Aryas, also about ordinary people. So, yeah. Yeah. You can. Remember Ananda at the Buddha's death. He was crying. Remember that? He was a stream enterer. So he was. But that is getting caught. But that is getting caught. You see? But I think that sadness is included because you are, you know, you are basically emotionally involving yourself in what's happening here. You're not able to stand back and see things just for what they are. Remember the Arahants? You can still get caught up in things even if you're stream enterer. There is an interesting sutta in the it's also in the Samyutta Nikaya somewhere where Mahanama, who's a cousin of the Buddha, he goes to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha that when I go into Kapilavatthu, which is a large city, which was the capital city of where the Buddha of the Sakyans, where the Buddha came from. When I get in there and I hear all the noise from the horses, the carriers, the elephants, and the people, everything, sometimes I get completely confused and I don't know what I'm doing. You know, what's going to happen to me when I get reborn? And the Buddha says, you know, you're okay because you have attained to stream entry. So you don't have any reason to be afraid where you're going to go when you get reborn. And yet you can see that when he goes into the city, he loses his mindfulness. He loses ability to see clearly. Yeah, that's precisely it. Yeah, exactly. It's a rebirth thing. And the more caught up you are. No, indeed. I mean, because you have the kind of the Dhamma in the back of your mind all the time, you know. So you, of course, you will be very quick in withdrawing. And then one of the things about a stream mentor, for example, if they do break a precept, they will confess it straight away. They can't hide anything. They can still break precepts. This is one of the interesting things. They can still do things which are wrong, but they can't hide those things anymore. And that is so the perfection or virtue of a stream mentor is actually the fact that they can't hide their misdemeanors, so to speak. They might do. I don't know. They might kill. I'm not sure. I can't answer that question for sure. It's only the Arahant. It's probably very unlikely, it's unlikely, but you find in the suttas that the only person who cannot kill any living beings, the only person who cannot break the five precepts, is the Arahat, the only person. So it is more unlikely, it is maybe even very unlikely, but it can happen, so yeah.